Ladies and gentlemen, well done for getting here, and I hope it's not going to be too cold for you, but it's a very warm welcome that I offer on behalf of the Dean and Chapter. So we're very pleased indeed to have Professor Janet Soskus with us here this evening to deliver the Charles Gore Lecture. Charles Gore, people will know, was born in 1853 and lived until 1932. He was a canon of Westminster between 1894 and 1902, a passionate leader of the Christian socialist movement, founder of the Community of the Resurrection, which began here in the little cloister, an Anglican order of brothers now based in Merfield in West Yorkshire. In his honour, and to maintain a theological contribution to public service, a series of annual lectures was established here in Westminster Abbey, and since 1935, a lecture has been held more or less every year. So the Gore Lecture now takes place within the spring programme of Westminster Abbey Institute, which we founded in 2013, to nurture and revitalize moral and spiritual values in public life and service. And in pursuit of this goal, the spring program this year is on the subject of truth, no small matter. So we're particularly honored to have Professor Janet Soskus as our 2018 Gore Lecturer. As the biography on your seat indicates, Professor Soskus is Professor of Philosophical Theology at Cambridge University. Until last year, she was president of her college, Jesus College, Cambridge, and also head of the Faculty of Theology. She's been extremely influential, both academically in her work on metaphor and religious language, and also in interfaith and interdenominational relations. And tonight, she'll share her wisdom on truth and beauty. As you see, the whole thing is being recorded, and there will be an opportunity, therefore, both to see it again on the Westminster Abbey Institute part of Westminster Abbey's website, and to listen to it again. But there will also be an opportunity after the lecture to ask a few questions. That'll be dependent on how extensive they are and how verbose they are. So, brief, punchy questions at the end. Thank you very much. But now, will you very warmly welcome Professor Soskus.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dean, and my thanks to the Westminster Institute for inviting me to give this first of the Institute's spring lectures on truth. Can I ask, am I audible to you all? Because there are wonderful people who can change the... Yes? Yes? No? Better? Better now? Yes, just raise your hand at the back if I cease to be audible, and we'll see what we can do. As you've heard, this lecture is in honor of Charles Gore, one-time canon here, and one of the 19th century's most influential theologians, both by what he said and wrote by his commitment to social action. Gore was concerned through the whole of his life with what he called the true life for men, a life he described in his commentary on the Epistles of St. John as life lived in the light, a life of unworldly, unselfish fellowship and pure self-control. Now, I can see, or I imagine, you are all swamped by this effulgence of Victorian sentiment. But to give Gore his credit, this text was based on lectures delivered here in 1900, but revised for publication by Gore in 1920 after fully observing the horrors of the First World War. Despite this, Gore continued to believe in the good life, which he saw anchored in the Gospels, and it was in the good life, in the deepest sense, he said, natural and true. And his Gifford Lectures of 1929 were delivered on the theme of the philosophy of the good life. There, ranging over a number of thinkers and traditions, Plato, Buddha, Zarathustra, he argued that the philosophy of the good life is of importance to us all. The state, he says, quoting Aristotle, comes into existence for the sake of life, but it exists for the sake of the good life. Gore lived, no less than ourselves, in times of urgency and need, and maybe more than ourselves. He would no doubt approve of the Institute's choice of theme for this term's spring lectures, truth. That being said, my chosen topic, truth and beauty, may seem an odd one for a series offered in the first instance to those in public service. Their lives, your lives, we all know are full of complexities. A good policy may have a bad result. What is good for one set of objectives is destructive to another. And one of my first duties as lecturer is surely to thank our public servants for doing a difficult job in a time when they receive too little praise. It may seem nonetheless that to pair truth and beauty is merely to join one highly contested notion with another. And to do so in the nave of a church, even if it's a very splendid church, is to add a further layer of irrelevance. Yet Christianity has a long experience of the question of truth. What is truth? Pontius Pilate, whatever else he was a public servant when he asked Jesus this question. And Christianity has, equally, a long history of getting it wrong and doing the wrong thing for the right reason. Peter, the rock on whom the church was founded, denied Christ three times before the cock crowed. If it had been the high priest himself, instead of a mere serving girl, who asked Peter as he stood by the brazier, "Don't you one of his followers?" I don't doubt that Peter would have stood forward bravely and said, "Yes, indeed I am." But for a mere serving girl? I doubt that truth is a word much in use in daily life in Westminster and Whitehall. And this is not because public servants are not concerned with truth, but because truth in application is always in context. If you ask me the true weight of my wedding ring, I may want to know, if I'm being very fussy, whether you want your answer in grams or if your question is about the atomic weight of gold. Wittgenstein taught us this much: don't ask for meaning, ask for use. And this is especially so with a word like truth. The atomic weight of gold, by the way, I discovered when writing this lecture, has been revised since 2013. So do be careful there. Nothing is truly sacred. The seven principles of public life laid down by the Committee on Standards as the basic ethical standard for public office holders, the Nolan principles, are selfishness, integrity, objectivity, accountability, openness, honesty, and leadership. A list that sounds not much less aspirational than that of Gore. This list does not include truth, but this is because truth subtends them all: integrity, objectivity, openness, and honesty. No wonder then that the Institute, which understands its brief to listen to public servants, finds that they are worried about the disenfranchising of truth. Is truth, to quote the brief for all four of these lectures, in shorter supply than it used to be? How can it be recognized, and where can it be found? Which brings me back to my early admission. If truth is difficult to find, is beauty that much easier? In classical Christian teaching, God is not only beautiful, but beauty itself. Not only truthful, but truth itself. Not only good, but goodness itself. What can this mean in our hectic world where truth is contested, goodness sounds priggish, and beauty discussed mainly in terms of revolutionary new beauty products? If truth is contested, then beauty, or at least the educated discussion of beauty, seems almost under a ban. Even art students seem reluctant to speak of beauty today for fear of appearing gauche and naive. Do we, in the age of Instagram, hear the adage, "Beauty is only skin deep," not as warning, but as stipulation. Beauty is only appearance, and appearance is all there is. And if so, what can this have to do with truth, or for that matter, with God? Truth has been under assault for some time, if not in the White House, then in the Academy. Nietzsche rejoiced that the death of God, hastened, as he thought, by Darwinian science, meant the end of truth. Both God and truth were, to his mind, crippling and superfluous mirages. "What then is truth," he wrote, "but a movable host of metaphors, metonymies, and anthropomorphisms? They are illusions which we have forgotten are illusions." Nietzsche nevertheless wanted somewhat inconsistently to retain belief in beauty, at least as a consolation to make human life bearable. Nietzsche's great contemporary, John Ruskin, was not so confident beauty could be retained. Ruskin's early art criticism rested on a form of natural theology familiar since the 18th century and virtually ubiquitous in English intellectual life in the early 19th century when he wrote. He believed, Ruskin, at this time, that the certainties of the evangelical faith of his childhood were in perfect consort with the new findings of scientists, at this time the geologists. God had delivered sermons in stone. Nature and nature's beauty was God's second book, and the beauty of the natural world was a moral beauty. But after Darwin, the water lily, with its exquisite cup, could no longer be seen as devised for godly instruction, but was exposed as a sexual organ in a new and unlovely drama of survival and propagation. The finely structured lily pads, we would have to say, merely appeared to us to be beautiful. Bees alighting on flowers were mere pimps and panders. As the art critic Peter Fuller records in his book on Ruskin's crisis of faith, Theoria, Art in the Absence of Grace, the early Ruskin begged the scholars of flowers to have nothing to do with the obscene processes and prurient apparitions of secular biologists. Fuller remarks, "To us such sentiments sound absurd, but Ruskin was drawing attention to the fact that the advance of one way of looking at nature had meant the loss of another. Behind his prudery lay another, deeper fear, that of the loss of the enchantment of the world." In the course of time, Ruskin would have a reconversion which allowed him to keep his faith, and while his early aesthetic theory lay slaughtered on the ground, he found a new one which enabled him for the first time to praise Veronese, a painter previously too sensual for his liking. We might say, though, that something of a hangover remained. The fear that all we value as beautiful is mere appearance. Nietzsche, for his part, could delight in mere appearance. He praised the Greeks for stopping at surfaces. "Those Greeks were superficial," he says in The Gay Science, "out of profundity." Are we, however, content to be superficial out of superficiality? Have we indeed taken superficiality to new depths? For while men and women have always been concerned about their appearance, and nothing wrong with that, I gave some thought to what I would wear this evening, but actually mostly to how warm I might be in it. In the age of Instagram, we don't conceal, but we openly acknowledge that our images are selected, edited, even airbrushed. We are each one our own curator. If I appear to my followers to be happy and successful, maybe that's all there is to happiness and success. In short, we are content not just with appearances, but with the appearance of appearances. Are we swindling ourselves out of the older insight that we are made to seek the truth and to behold beauty? In the 1960s, the American abstract painter Jack Torkoff wrote that he wished he could return to representational painting, but that this would only be possible if the visible world stood as a sign of transcendence. The argument doesn't follow, because abstract paintings can fully testify to the transcendent, and representational painting can live with the mantra that surfaces are all that there is for us. I suggest to you, in the latter category, Lucian Freud's nudes, which I hasten to say are very great paintings by a superb figurative artist, yet are bleakly content that flesh, perhaps meat, is all there is and is all that we are. These paintings are, in their way, no less ideological or preachy than Piero della Francesca's Baptism of Christ in the National Gallery, which, with its deeply pondered forms, is meant by sight to direct us to an order we cannot see. Yet Torkoff's was a common line of thought at his time, as the beautiful was consigned to the dust heap by many 20th century artists, perhaps for bearing the toxic residue of the divine or some other hegemonic power. If, as Nietzsche thought, transcendence must be left behind, then what is its residue? Perhaps we will find the glory of the Superman, as Nietzsche hoped. But David Bentley Hart suggests it might just as well be banality. Given our culture's devotion to acquisition, celebrity, distraction, and therapy, he says, it is not hard to think that our vision as people has narrowed to the smaller preoccupations and desires of individual selves. Perhaps, Hart continues, this is simply what happens when human beings are worried, are liberated from want and worry, and we should gratefully embrace the triviality of a world that revolves around television, shopping, and the internet as a kind of blessedness that our ancestors, oppressed by miseries we can scarcely now imagine, never even hoped to enjoy in this world. Ironically, this would represent Nietzsche's greatest fear, the loss of any transcendent imagination that could coax mighty works of cultural imagination out of a people. The aspiring ape, Hart says, ceases to think of himself as a fallen angel. He may inevitably resign himself to being an ape and seeking no more than an ape's contentment. But not all religiously informed aesthetic depends on the argument from design that underwrote Ruskin's early writings. The artistry of Gerard Manley Hopkins was, as a poet, not of appearances, but of appearings, epiphanies of individual things, a coal falling gashed and glowing into the grate, the mossy rim of a well, stones seen through clear water. Hopkins, like Cézanne, wrestled beauty from mere appearances to think instead of the world's astonishing capacity to appear. Surely this is so with both beauty and truth. The best reply to Nietzsche's dismissal of truth, which he had in the end to extend also to the claims of science as well as other putative truths, is the success of science itself. If truth is in every sense a mere human construct and a tissue of illusion, the success of modern science is a miracle. Instead, we find that science proceeds in the belief that there is a given, a world which has been disclosed to us through generations of arduous and patient attention. And what is wrong, after all, with metaphors and human constructs, and even with mobile hosts of metaphors? Scientific theory frequently proceeds by means of them. It is, or was, a metaphor based on a hydraulic model to say that electricity has a current or flows through a wire. But we don't say this language is only metaphorically true and put a live wire into our mouths. We construct theories about how our world works, just as we must contrive laws and systems of government. That we do so shows us to be anchored in the world of givens, not at a remove from it. But how does beauty appear? Ellen Skerry, in her essay On Beauty, observes that while beauty's been banished in the language of the humanities for the last few decades, it is openly at play in those fields which aspire to truth as their object. Math, physics, astrophysics, chemistry, biochemistry, where every day in the laboratories and seminar rooms, participants speak of problems that are nice, theories that are pretty, solutions that are elegant and simple. Beauty goes on in its durable way, and in common speech, people freely speak of a beautiful goal in football, a beautiful shot in tennis, or a beautiful souffle. There is something there of accuracy, fittingness, and appropriateness to an end. Elaine Sgarry suggests that if you ask people to give an example of an intellectual error they've made in their lives, few can do so. But almost everyone is able, she says, to describe an error they've made about beauty. She gives her own case, palm trees. She had ruled out palm trees as objects of beauty and one day discovered she had made a mistake. Suddenly, she writes, I am on a balcony with its huge swaying leaves before me at eye level, arcing, arching, waving, cresting, and breaking in the soft air, throwing the yellow sunlight up over itself and catching it on the other side, running its fingers down its own piano keys, then running them back again. On reading this passage, I felt similarly accused as a non-lover of palm trees. But more than that, I instantly recognized one of my own errors in beauty. I was on Vancouver Island, the part of the world I hail from, standing with a friend overlooking a rocky, pine-clad shoreline with the sunlit Georgia Strait and beyond the snow-clad mountains of the Canadian mainland before us. This picturesque view directed our conversation. My friend had grown up on the Canadian prairies, and he said, "You know, people always tell me how lucky I am to have ended up on the West Coast, but I miss the prairies." On the West Coast, he explained, there was a superfluity of the visual. The eye was commanded in every direction. On the prairies, by contrast, there was in the vastness apparently little to be seen. The eye had to search for the red of a single flower in the sprouting crop, the shape of the clouds, the gleam of wheat as it reflected changes in the sky. Listening to him speak, I felt immediately ashamed as one who had never given the prairies a second thought in the beauty direction. The prairies were my palm tree. I didn't need to go to the Canadian prairies to know that I had been wrong. My friend, through his attentiveness, had revealed a beauty to me which I had not seen or looked for. So in manners of beauty, as in manners of truth, we can find ourselves corrected. I could be convicted of the truth of what my friend was saying without visiting the prairies, and it would alter my understanding of other prairie-like landscapes I found myself in, for instance, the Cambridgeshire Fens. Although beauty has the reputation of being merely subjective, we must all have had similar experiences of being inducted into beauty. Most of us recognize daffodil shoots breaking through the soil at this time of year. But when you walk through the deadness of a winter garden with a gardener, they can see that this will be a foxglove, and over there an unpromising stump will be in June a peony. The whole summer garden lies before them on a desolate February day. We can learn from such people. It may prompt us to want to be gardeners ourselves. We can be schooled in sight, apprenticed in disclosure of winter gardens, of flocks of birds, clusters of cells, or the beauty of a mathematical puzzle. The experience of beauty can startle us as it sometimes comes across as something unbidden. In Elaine Sgarry's view, beauty ignites the desire for truth. It amounts to something of a disclosure, she says, of that which is. It is around this matter of appearing that, perhaps strange to relate, the practice of science not only points to beauty, but brings us to a moment where we may consider what it means to say that God is not only beautiful, but beauty itself, not only truthful, but truth itself, not only good, but goodness itself. The scholastic theologians called certain truths, terms, one, good, true beauty, transcendentals, because they considered them to be aspects of all that truly is, or as they would say, of being itself. The idea that God is being itself may be to us just a remote one, or seem just a residue of Platonism in Christianity. And that lineage is certainly there. Not just Platonism, but various of the world's philosophies and religions have suggested that we are made for the good and to seek the good, or that the beauty of the world is an emanation of a supreme beauty. I welcome this. However, I suggest that this basic conception, as found in classical antiquity, was fundamentally transformed by Jews, Christians, and later Muslims in their teaching on creation. Not the story that the world was made in 6 days, but the central teaching of creation from nothing, creatio ex nihilo. In this, God is not somehow continuous with or correlative to the natural order, as was the case in Aristotle, but rather God is the creator of all that is. God creates all that is, even space and time, and moreover, God does so freely, from no compulsion, nor is this any inevitable emanation, as in, for instance, the sun, which just has to shine. The biblical teachings that directed creation ex nihilo were taken not principally from the book of Genesis, although from there too, but from the Psalms, the prophets, and from the book of Exodus, where God, when asked by Moses for a name, says, I am who I am. This I am declared to Moses was routinely connected by early theologians of the church to the creation narratives of the first chapters of Genesis, and the understanding that God is the one who truly is, and God is the one from whom all creatures have their being. A number of things follow. If God is the creator of all that is, including space and time, the moment of creation is not a long time ago, but now. And it is equally foolish to ask, as Augustine sharply remarked, what God was doing before the world was created. There can be no before creation, no before time, and no time when there was no space or matter, as even the astrophysicists today can agree. God, as creator of time and space, is equally present to all time and space. God is thus nearer to me, as Augustine would say, than my breath, creating and holding me in being at all times. According to this logic of creation, everything that is gift. Creation has its being at every moment and at every now, and not just at some initial big bang of a moment, from a loving God. This is the logic behind Julian of Norwich's epiphany when she saw the world as tiny, lying like a hazelnut in the palm of her hand. Please note, she does not see the world as lying like a hazelnut in the palm of God's hand, which would be a frightening Wizard of Oz quite image, but lying in the palm of her own hand. She notes its beauty, its fragility, yet it exists, she says, because God loves it. And nothing, she believed, could change the love of God. It is this element that unites, or perhaps it is better to say, aligns beauty and truth. The world in its beauty appears to us never neat or unmediated or without theories or metaphors, but nonetheless unsolicited as a gift of something that is there, but we have not seen before. Beauty takes us out of ourselves. We are no longer just the center of our own universe. It can be not the end, but the beginning of an apprenticeship in seeing more. Beauty is thus said sometimes to be the radiance of the true and the good. It is attractive. But isn't it exaggerated, romantic to think most people will seek beauty. Not at all, according to Aquinas. They will seek beauty in the same way that they seek good. But this seems even more outlandish, for people patently don't seek the good. According to Aquinas, people do. They always seek the good. He may seem optimistic, but it comes down to his Aristotelian common sense. Thomas's ethics are fundamentally eudaimonistic. That is, they're about happiness. We seek what makes us happy. That is part of our animal or creaturely nature. We seek what is good for us in the same way as the sunflower turns to the sun. With this qualification, human beings as reasoning creatures can mistake our goods. We may think it is better to bet all our wages on a horse than to pay the rent. Not his example, but there you go. Nonetheless, we desire the good, which in the end, of course, he says, is God, the source of our being and our life. Leading the good life is about following your heart's desire. So Aquinas and Augustine before him believed, but desires properly schooled. I favor this kind of ethical theory because it's plausible and also because it unites our moral and our practical lives, our search for the true with our search for the good and the beautiful. However, before being carried away, we need to remind ourselves, and I'm sure none of you have forgotten, that the world contains sorrows, hardships, and cruelties. The Catholic poet and painter David Jones, in his essay Art and Sacrament, makes this barbed comment. Were we trying to discover what it meant to say nature is beautiful, we'd be best advised to consider the patterns made by germ cells of a formidable disease than by considering the female torso, the green hills, or the dog rose. Jones, a boy from a modest background, had his art school studies interrupted by his time in the trenches during the First World War. In cautioning against too easy a resort to the beauties of nature, he may have in mind the vulnerability of the Sermons in Stone approach to beauty, which informed the young Ruskin. When faced with the cruelty and rapacity of the actual workings of Mother Nature, and indeed of ourselves. But I believe that Jones, an artist who above all thought of himself as a craftsman, believed there to be a theological deficiency in the suggestion implicit in the Book of Nature approach that the human being or the artist is the passive recipient of this kind of divine teaching. As though God were somehow customizing the created order by hiding in it uplifting tales of beauty, coded messages which human beings, somehow suspended between God and the animals, were the intended beneficiaries. Weak as this approach to beauty is on the doctrine of God and of the human being, it entirely lacks any doctrine of Christ. And here it must be said, there is a paramount difference between the Christian understanding of God as the source of all and that of the antique philosophers where the good is an impersonal fecundity from which everything else emanates. The biblical I am who I am, the I am who is being itself, spoke to Moses. And in Christian understanding, this same I am, the word through whom all things were made, is the word which, in the prologue to John's Gospels we read, became flesh and dwelt amongst us. It is no accident that in the Gospel of John, Jesus repeatedly identifies himself with the I am who spoke to Moses. Before Abraham was, I am. In John's Gospel, Christ is the creative word which becomes incarnate and a human being like us in every way, in a world of harsh realities. Indeed, I think it is this balance between the glory of the creative word, become flesh, and the sometime painful actuality of human existence that saves good Christian art from being a motherhood and apple pie celebration of beauty. Think again of Piero della Francesca's Baptism of Christ in the National Gallery. The order and balance of the painting, its stillness and seeming moment of eternal calm, is there, yes, but so too is a sense of movement, of uncertainty, as the Baptist lifts one foot to pour water over the head of Jesus. Any seeing the painting who know the story will know that Jesus goes on from this scene to the temptation in the wilderness. Jesus' bare white chest is vulnerable. The pink cloak, calmly held by an angel, is a pastel anticipation of the purple garment in which Jesus will be cloaked when he's mocked by the soldiers as King of the Jews. It is the same cloth that Piero puts in a companion painting, clothing the resurrected Christ when he emerges from the tomb. The Incarnation is a profound endorsement of the fundamental good of material reality and of being human, bodily, corporeal. John Ruskin was horrified to think that the mollusk might be the ancestor of man, and many Victorian Christians were scandalized that human beings should be classed as animals. David Jones, by contrast, delighted in the conviction, as he termed it, that we are, and I quote, the animal who is the artist, always firmly anchored in our fleshly, bodily existence. I'd like to read from one of his letters, which recalls an incident during the First World War and before he became a Catholic. And I'm reading his words so we can catch the tone of his voice. It's a letter to Rennie Haig. It was after the Somme, I think, so when I had returned to France from being wounded, as I was always cold, one of my main preoccupations was to hunt for any wood that was dry and could be used to make a decent fire. Just a little way back, between our support trench and the reserve line, I noticed what had been a farm building, now a wreckage in the main owing to shell fire. No individual of any kind was about, but I thought, now that looks to be most likely the very place where there might be not only broken cartwheels or other discarded bits of timber, but with a bit of luck, a wood store, perfectly dry and ready for use. So I went to investigate, and when I came close to the wall, found it had been a bit more knocked about than what it appeared. But there was no door or any opening of any sort in that side. But I found a crack against which I put my eye, expecting to see either empty darkness or that I should have to go around to the other side. But what I saw through the small gap in the wall was not the dim emptiness I had expected, but the back of a sacerdote in a gilt-hued planeta. 2 points of flickering candle light, no doubt, lent an extra sense of goldness to the vestments and a golden warmth to the white altar cloth. And kneeling in the hay were huddled figures in khaki, a big-bodied Irishman and an Italian nationalized Englishman. You can imagine, Jones writes, what a great marvel it was for me to see through that clink in the wall. I didn't think I ought to stay long, he says, as it seemed rather like an uninitiated bloke prying into the mysteries of a cult, but it made a big impression on me. I then had to seek elsewhere for my firewood. We can all sense the astonishment of Jones, only very loosely Christian at this time, at being unexpectedly in the midst of a wasteland and arduous and necessary labor struck by this vision. It was neither inexplicable nor unexplained, but peering through a crack in the wood, he saw or had an epiphany, the back of a vested priest, a makeshift altar with candles, the white cloth of an altar and vestments glowing, and the transformation of the men he knew but had not seen in this way, kneeling there. What he saw in the warm candlelight in the midst of a ruined waste was, to use the archaic language favored by Jones, a confecting. which means the making of something by putting together. Here, the confecting of a sacrament, a human and divine moment transforming not just the bread and the wine, but the kneeling men. For Jones, printmaker, calligrapher, painter, carver, poet, art is always a confecting, the intentional alignment of one thing or shape with another, whether of ink or pigment or stone or words. Such a thing he understood in the deepest sense to be sacramental activity, a making sacred. This was to continue the work of Christ and to understand himself as a member of the body of Christ. The gratuitous creative activity of the artist is the rational response to the givenness of an unfathomably beautiful world that surrounds us. As with our confecting of beauty, so too with truth. Truth, like goodness and beauty, is not something we possess neat, as though we could or even should want to jump out of every particular human context. Truth, like beauty, is both a given and a work in progress. But if these are the very ground of our being, then our fulfillment as reasoning creatures is to make these manifest. All people, Jones believed, are artists of some sort, capable of representing, or as he was fond of saying, representing things under a different form. This is as true of the ochre sketch of a stag in a cave painting as of the icon which represents the saint under the form of wood and oil and pigment. It is true, Jones says, of someone who bakes a birthday cake. It is true of someone who drafts a new legislation or who plants trees along motorway verges. It is true of one who teaches. Jones gave the example of the art of strategy. We could speak of the art of public service. The grandeur of God is displayed, to return to Hopkins, not just in kingfishers that catch fire or shining shook foil, but in works of human justice. The just man justices, keeps grace, that keeps all his goings graces, acts in God's eyes what in God's eyes he is, Christ, for Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes, not his, through the Father, through the features of men's faces. This is perhaps the good life as Gore described it, a life lived in the deepest sense, naturally and truly. We are created to be artists, individually and collectively making things lovely. And this artistry does not make us angels, but truly and beautifully and fully ourselves. Thank you.
Well, there'll be some questions, but I'm fascinated by the thought that that people nowadays are very content to say, this is truth for me, or this is my truth, it's different from your truth, and there is no objective sense of truth. And I'm wondering whether there's any way that we can dialogue with that effectively from the point of view of the Christian understanding of truth. I don't know whether there's any way of getting from beauty to truth. The idea of beauty is more open to the idea of an absolute truth, of an objective truth, maybe. And is there any way that that can be argued towards a sense of objective truth?
Thank you. Well, I was hoping it was rather less. I was hoping that most people would think it's rather less obvious that we have an objective sense of beauty. That's, you know, people often say, oh, well, I know what I like, or something like that. And that's what I liked about Elaine Scarry's book, which is called On Beauty and Being Just. I realize I didn't give the full title, On Beauty and Being Just. But I think there, you know, the argument still holds. People may say, this is truth for me. But when they're in a medical crisis, they don't want their doctor to say that. I mean, we don't actually behave in our life, you know. You don't actually walk in front of the bus saying, well, for me, there's no bus there. I mean, you don't live your life in that way. We do behave as though there are things we can know. The fact that we can make mistakes and have to revise, I think, is simply to be human. And in a way, Nietzsche, who actually jumps about quite a lot in what he's after when he's so dismissive of truth, and did want to keep scientific truth, but in the end realized he couldn't quite to be consistent, is just pitching the standard far too high. And I think there, when you get to the question, your question, what can the religions have to say, I think that it's unfortunate that Christianity and the other faith traditions are sort of put about, or maybe have put themselves about, as great possessors of truth in some absolute sense. I think it's one attractive feature of Christianity to me is that the four Gospels that we have, it was realized from very early on, from the second century, that they weren't entirely consistent, that there were contradictions in some of the narratives in them, the of the last days of Jesus, for instance. And some people said, well, that's easy. We'll just write one version that, you know, smooths them all out. But the early bishops resisted that. They thought it was better to have the four narratives, even if they conflicted, than to just pretend there weren't the inconsistency there. I think Christianity hasn't always been very good at admitting that it lives with these things, but I think for me, this is one of the glories, and may be an area where traditional institutions like this one have something to put in.
Thank you very much. Now, there is a man with a microphone. So I think there's a question from Claire right at the front here. From Dr. Foster Gilbert.
Thank you. Janet, thank you very much for your lecture. I'd love to hear more of your thoughts on the beauty of public service.
Well, I think I am attracted, you will have gathered, to David Jones's notion of the artist as craftsman, as confecting, as putting things together and confecting. You know, again, we only use that now in confectionery now. That's not perhaps the best example. But this putting together, making things come together into new forms and shapes, And that he is happily able to see that in all of human life that is constructive. And I think that, you know, one thing we could do is add beauty to the Nolan principles. We could do that. Perhaps we should. But I think that this idea of thinking that what we're about is a task of restoring an integrity, a wholeness, a fittingness to things, is something that we can't be smug about, but something that must be there. It's rather like, you know, again, it's perhaps a more useful notion in some senses than truth, which doesn't seem to me to apply in every sense to what public servants might do. However, there, if you think of the beauty, the beautiful goal in football, the beautiful souffle, the beautiful shot, there's something about a fittingness, a fitness for purpose, that is surely what many or most of us are trying to do all the time in whatever we're doing, bringing up children, working in the law.
So do we have another Tristan? Just right at the front here. Right at the end, your furthest walk.
Thank you, Professor. When you were speaking about your experience of almost correcting an error and seeing the beauty in something, I was wondering if you thought it was because you saw the truth behind the beauty. Is what is beautiful what is true, or what is too beautiful if God is all of these things in his simplicity, but then one in reality, multiple in idea?
A very, very good point, to which you probably know the answer. In medieval thought, these transcendentals were convertible. They were all aspects of being. So the good was the true, was the beautiful, was being itself. So in a way, there was a prismatic aspect, they felt, to seeing the one through the other. And I think Elaine Scarry, who is not a religious writer, and I thought her book was useful for that purpose. I have no idea what her own predilections are, but it isn't a book about theology in any sense. I think that she does think that there is some way in which beauty leads us to justice, leads us to truth. But these are all what may be helpful is to think through some of these transcendentals almost as though our thoughts are spiritual exercises, if you see what I mean. That perhaps if we think through truth in terms of beauty and a recognition we might make, that might loosen our limbs about in thinking about truth, instead of getting all the time very polarized about what is exactly that and exactly that. So I suppose the idea is that as a kind of exercise and discernment, and I use the apprenticeship, I think we can all recognize this kind of apprenticeships and being taught by other people, even in things that might appear to be totally subjective, like beauty, that does come together and inform our understanding of truth as well.
So we have a question here
in the front row, and then one just behind in the second row after that.
Professor Soskis, I seem to recall that Dorothy L. Sayers tried to draw an analogy in the book Mind of the Maker between the writer or the artist and the doctrine of the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see anything in the endeavour of the artist and the pursuit of an absolute in the way that perhaps she did?
I do. It would probably be another lecture to connect it with the doctrine of the Trinity, I do feel that. Well, let me put it this way: part of the reason Nietzsche wanted to get rid of truth, it seems, and God, is he felt these held up unattainable standards by which we were always falling short, always mere mortals, you know. This is, I think, to have a mistake at the outset, not least a kind of mistaken anthropomorphic picture of God as a great guy in the sky, which a lot of 19th century deistic thought rather projected. But if instead we think of God as the source of our being, that from which all flows, whether you call that being or whether you call that love, as Dante did, someone who Dorothy Sayers also loved very much, then this is not something in competition with us. We can't be in competition with God. God is holding us in being at every moment. And so this absolute is there, and our turning toward the absolute, and I would there use the image, it's rather a simple image, but of the sunflower turning to the sun. It's just what we are designed to do. And in that sense, I think the idea of an absolute or a telos can be very helpful. And I think that I see amongst a lot of, say, undergraduates that I run across that they've lost any sense that there can be some kind of unity between our moral and our aesthetic and our scholarly lives. I'm not saying they're not trying this, but I'm saying that somehow this unity that one finds in Dante or Augustine or Aquinas, we've been given the impression it's lost to us. We can't believe in it. Why? Because of what? Modern science? But no, that doesn't work. There's no reason why we can't believe that, why we can't start from the mystery that there is a world at all, that it appears to us. and move to this kind of line of thinking. And there, I think, as you may imagine, it is something I'd like to return to. I think, in some ways, the virtue ethics of people like Alistair MacIntyre and those who he's inspired do move in this direction, and I think it's welcome because it provides a kind of a unity to our human being, a unity not just, as I said, that our life in our pursuits of sciences and our moral life, but with art. I mean, again, Dante's Divine Comedy is a great poem of this, where it is love, but of course love is also convertible with this. Love, which is the being of itself, through whom all that was made, that is all thing is seeking and moving to. And these things I find, for instance, my students are very receptive to these kind of notions.
So we have a question just there, and then there's a question in the fourth row there.
Thank you, Professor Soskis. I'm coming from a justice point of view, mm-hmm. and hopefully a practical kind of view. So if all that God created is good, mm-hmm. I was just wondering, how did Nietzsche's Superman theory, which influenced Hitler's chosen form of beauty, how did that impact on the church of the day? How did it blind them? And how can we stop that happening again?
Yeah. Well, Nietzsche, of course, was openly an atheist, and his impact on the church was thus, you might say, negative. He was never embraced as a major source of piety, although he was read as something one needs seriously to take account of. And I think there were some very unfortunate elements of Nietzsche. It's difficult. Your question is difficult because partly Nietzsche does get ladled with a lot of things that probably weren't quite him but were ladled in. It is true that this aspect of the Superman and despised Christianity, favoring the weak, for being just boosting up the... He wanted strong men. It was a very masculine kind of philosophy. He wanted strong men who can control things, who move boldly through without worrying about slaughtering the weak to the right and the left. And sort of Christianity was despicable to him for this. In some ways, you could say the church has never really warmed to this message. They warm to a kind of Darwinisticness that is associated with Nietzsche. For instance, there's a very sad history in the 1920s of the churches, mostly in the States, but perhaps also here, being pretty pleased with the eugenic movement, right? So that certain people didn't have a right to reproduce and so on. I don't think that there's any way we can protect ourselves from such errors other than being very openly honest and saying we have made them. I suppose that would be what I would say. Thank you.
So I think the last question now, just over here. There'd be a chance for some conversation afterwards, perhaps.
Thank you, Professor. My question was I liked very much your example of your way of speaking, talking about apprenticeships. Mm-hmm. As a way of learning to apprehend truth and also beauty. But it seems to me that there's a correlative sort of authority involved with this. How do you see that authority in our contemporary culture and maybe in relation with public service as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, this may be above my pay grade, but I think we... In the instances I mentioned, they were more common and literally common, or garden apprenticeship, where you find yourself going around with someone who really knows about gardens and you realize, wow, I don't, and that's amazing. Or sometimes you're with people who know a great deal about music. I don't mean true connoisseurship necessarily. You can be with someone who knows how to cook and suddenly you realize you don't, or something like that. So a lot of this is going on daily in small kinds of lives and small kinds of ways. And I think that we develop, I think the growing child develops a sense for this, develops a sense, you know, when they become suddenly obsessed with whatever it is, the way bikes work, and they hang out at a bike shop or something like that. They can find people they trust, and perhaps that's what ideally we would all like to find in our workplace. But the sad reality is that perhaps those people aren't always there. I think that, as I understand it, one thing the Westminster Institute is trying to do is precisely to think seriously about what kind of mentorships and apprenticeships might be, how these could work, because we do learn from each other in all things, and it's a wonderful thing about life. As I'll finish with one nice thing from Augustine, who's talking about why people should come and hear the preacher and why they shouldn't just be content to stay at home and read the Bible for themselves. He says, God could have put his truths in our brains just by means of angels, but he's designed it so we have to learn from other people so that we might be knit together by the ligatures of love. And I think this is a rather, rather nice truth.
Thank you very much.
I saw that on the back page of the Church Times last year, I think, or the year before, you mentioned that Augustine is the person you really wanted to be with when you get to heaven. So thank you very much for your quote from Augustine. Thank you.